Thanks for listening to The Herd Podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 12 to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. Find your local station for The Herd at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching Herd.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
What up? Welcome in. This is The Herd. Wherever you may be in, however you may be listening to the show, thanks so much. I'm Doug Gottlieb, filling in for Colin Cowherd, wishing you and yours the very merriest of Christmases and the happy Festivus to you. We will air some grievances throughout the show, including how James Harden is pulling a Costanza. That's right. James Harden is pulling a Costanza. Art imitates life, or life imitates art, and sports imitate Seinfeld. Don't believe it? We will make you a believer during the show. Welcome in. Chris Mannix will join us in 15 minutes. We'll get his thoughts on last night's NBA action. The old P, Petros Papadakis, will join us in 1 hour and 15 minutes. We'll talk some college football, some bizarre hires. USC still having the same coach that everybody likes USC football. And also we'll get his take on last night's, what I thought was, outstanding ring ceremony. Like, and that gets us to the best for last, which is at the end of the show, where I kind of think the ring ceremony last night for the NBA was a hit. And there are some other things which we have learned, or we have grown to appreciate, we've grown to love during this time of COVID-19 that we probably wouldn't have if not for being quarantined and kept social distance from each other. So we got a lot to get to. Darius Butler, who's a former Pats and Colts defensive back, will join us as well in the show. Welcome in. I got a thought. You know, Colin has been riding this where Colin was right. He was right about the Pittsburgh Steelers, but it shows where Colin was wrong about the Green Bay Packers. The Packers organization looks brilliant in the last week, and if you watch the Steelers, you know why. All right, got that to come. Let's get to the NBA. First, the Brooklyn Nets. You're like, why are you starting with Brooklyn? If you wondered why people put up with Kyrie Irving, my God, he's a lot, right? Saging the court. we don't really need a head coach. World is flat. I want to stay in Boston. Boston can't stand you. Boston can't get rid of you. If you wondered why, that's why. And while there's all kinds of questions that are still to be answered, I got to tell you, the early returns, and if November taught us anything, early returns don't actually mean everything, right? It's what happens at the end when every score and ballot is counted. That's actually what matters. But the early returns on the Brooklyn Nets is, man, they not only have incredible talent, they're a pretty well put together roster, right? Like, you have another guard in Spencer Dinwiddie, LA kid, for when Kyrie goes all Kyrie. You got Joe Harris, who's a great shooter, who can just open up the floor. And you got a rim protector in DeAndre Jordan. And the bench ain't bad either. Early returns are, and I'll tell you why later in the show, that the Warriors being done, most of it has nothing to do with Klay. And I'll explain why. But let me start with the Lakers. And the Clippers. The Clippers won their second NBA championship last night, or it only seems that way to Clippers Nation. There is no Clippers Nation. Even a Clipper fan will tell you there ain't no Clippers Nation. That the Clippers pulling a Clippers last year in the playoffs was pretty much par for the course. That said, what we have a tendency to do, not a tendency, we just do, is we're result-oriented people. And because the result is the Lakers won their 17th NBA title last year, because LeBron was the finals MVP, and because the Lakers roster on paper got better, they're not only the best team in the NBA, they got better than last year. Things we failed to mention. They didn't play the Clippers. They didn't play the Bucks. And they probably weren't the best team in terms of collection of talent, but they were the best team in terms of cohesion. We don't know if that's what happens with this roster. We don't know how Dennis Schroeder reacts to a big playoff run. We don't know if Kyle Kuzma gets better or gets worse. Looked better last night offensively, but we don't know how much he will play. There's a lot we don't know. But did anybody else notice that while the Clippers may have won their NBA championship, they looked better, right? They look. Now, I don't know if Nicholas Batum suddenly remembered how to play basketball like he did before he signed that gargantuan contract with Charlotte. And I don't know if Marc Gasol is going to look like he's washed up the entire year. But the Clippers last year did not have great chemistry. And that was only made more prominent and more obvious when they played in the bubble. They were a bad bubble team. Lou Williams didn't want to be there. Montrezl Harrell didn't want to be there. There was infighting over Paul George and his role, and Paul George didn't like the way he was used. And so they moved Doc out. They moved, you move a head coach who has an NBA championship to his name, one seat over in Ty Lue. You change offenses, which focuses more on the strength of Paul George. You add in a 3-and-D wing. You add in a rim protector in Serge Ibaka, something they did not have. And with all of the attention on the Lakers roster on paper getting much better, we should point out that the reason the Lakers knew they had to step up their game in their roster was they weren't a great team. They weren't a great collection of talent last year. They were a great team. They won because they stayed together, because of the leadership of LeBron, because of their defense, not because of their offense. And they know that the league is going to get better. And the Clippers will be better out of the bubble than they were in the bubble, and more cohesive in year two of those two stars playing together than they were in year one. I get it. It's a no-lose game for the Lakers. We've seen plenty of teams take a dump when they get their rings in the ring ceremony, and it screws everything up. And it's a little bit awkward to recognize basically half the roster isn't there anymore. And while I know that, Rob Pelinka is doing a very, very good job. The reason he's forced to do a very good job and move some pieces around is he knew his team wasn't all that good. They just got the most out of what they had and played together and stuck together. And, oh yeah, by the way, got the benefit of not having to play the Clippers or the Bucks on their path to an NBA championship. It doesn't mean they have to give it back. It doesn't mean they have to apologize for it. It doesn't mean it's an asterisk by the resume of one LeBron James. It doesn't mean any of that. It's just the reality of it. And if you want to be result-oriented, that's fine. You can. Okay? But the subtle nuances of last night were, look, the Clippers have evolved and done so nicely offensively, and it seems I like some of the fixes to their roster. I like Landry Shamet, but obviously they felt like they had to move him out, and now you got Reggie Jackson off that bench with Lou Williams. That's a pretty dynamic backcourt off the bench. I like Nick Batum. Yes, they overpaid for their Morris, but he's the better Morris. So I like Luke Kennard, who's a better shooter and a more efficient player than Kyle Kuzma, making more money than Kyle Kuzma. It's like, I understand that you're allowed to sit there as a Laker fan and go, ha, doesn't matter. Talk to me in the playoffs, Clippers. That's fair. And until something happens to change that perspective, that is a valid perspective. But I'm warning you, Laker guy and Clipper fan, and Clipper denier, that roster's better. That coach is a better fit. The Lakers had to fix some things, and fixing some things is a little bit like every time you have surgery, right? Every time you have surgery, every time you go inside somebody's body, something can go wrong. Every time you go to the bullpen, somebody can come out and perform worse than expectations. The Marc Gasol thing, I'm not sure there, kids. On paper, awesome. In reality, a shell of himself defensively, and maybe he plays his way into shape, but he wasn't the one who 72 days ago was playing in the bubble. No. His season's been over for a long time. So I'm cautiously optimistic about the Clippers. I am more than cautiously optimistic about the Nets. I am selling any Warrior stock. And while the Lakers lineup and roster on paper is definably better than it was last year, they didn't win last year because of their roster. And they got some breaks that went their way. And the more times you go in to try and fix some things, sometimes you screw some things up. I'm not sure if they're really the best team in the NBA, because we're asking that, well, Dennis Schroeder scores this many points there. How many will he score when he's the third option over here? I don't know if it works. Marc Gasol was a great defensive player. Was. 35 years old, big guy, doesn't age like LeBron. And the rest of the league has seemingly gotten better. Stay tuned. All right, coming up next. James Harden is in fact George Costanza. I can prove it to you next in The Herd.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
Doug Gottlieb for Colin. This is The Herd. Chris Mannix will join us, Sports Illustrated senior writer covering the NBA. He'll join us in moments. Today, I saw this on social media when I was actually parking the car. Al Dukes is a friend of mine. He's a producer of a New York City morning show. And his tweet was a good one. It was funny and allowed me to respond on Twitter as well, which it went a little something. It was no real back and forth. The back and forth went a little something like this. Al Hughes Dukes Al's boring tweets is his Twitter handle. I love Seinfeld more than any show in the history of shows, but the Festivus references this time of year gets old. To which I responded, the airing of grievances has begun.
Right? A Festivus for the rest of us!
Right? Happy Festivus to all of you. But, and this is really important, although that's the Seinfeld reference everyone's going to make today because of this time of year, that's not the one that's actually taking place. Did you guys see this? The NBA is investigating James Harden. There's a video of him getting Dior luggage from somebody calling him his best friend at a strip club in Houston. No mask on, no gloves, at a strip club. Okay, so again, to review, James Harden was a no-show the first couple days at Rockets training camp. They didn't know when he was going to be there, where he was going to be there. He's reportedly demanded a trade several times over to specific teams. Then when he finally did show up, he was in shape. Round is a shape. He was in shape. There's a report that there was some sort of kerfuffle, maybe even a fight over his effort and lack of fitness at training camp. And then there's video of James Harden, being James Harden, at a strip club, which is a direct violation of the NBA's COVID protocol. They are investigating. There's a strong likelihood he'll get suspended before tonight's game. There's a Seinfeld episode called The Millennium. In that episode, George Costanza does everything in his power to get himself fired.
Attention, Steinbrenner and front office morons. Your triumphs mean nothing. You all stink. You can sit on it and rotate.
That's George Costanza driving around the Yankee Stadium parking lot dragging the World Series trophy in tow. That, in fact, is exactly what James Harden is doing. What does it take for a guy to get fired around here, or at least traded? I think direct violation of COVID protocol will cost you a substantial amount of money in your pocket as well, but I'm guessing that strategy does, in fact, work. He's going to do next? Next, he's going to burn Hakeem Olajuwon's jersey, right? Like that is the last straw. That's the last straw. Or maybe he's going to say something bad about Tillman Fertitta's multitude of restaurants as a restaurateur. You know what? I never liked Morton's. and they bring out that beautiful piece of meat? Who does that? That's not safe. Let's welcome in Chris Mannix, senior NBA writer covering the league for Sports Illustrated. You can follow him on Twitter at @SiChrisMannix. Is that Harden's general philosophy here? What do I got to do to get fired? Is that why he's at a strip club, being James Harden?
You know, it's a good example, Doug. It's something that Costanza line and are seen is something I thought of, you know, when you saw the strip club report today. Basically, I mean, is the answer. I mean, he's, from everything I've been told, he is anxious, if not eager, to get out of there, that he's done with Houston. And look, I understand wanting a trade, and we can get into the ridiculousness of the guy that, you know, basically put the Rockets in this position, demanding out of it. But it's pretty embarrassing if you're James Harden. I don't know how significant the argument he had with, you know, another teammate in practice. I mean, you played the game, Doug. You know, that stuff happens all the time.
Correct.
I hear stuff about guys getting into fights constantly. But, you know, the idea that you would potentially be breaking protocol days before or the day of your season opener is wild. And if you're a team acquiring him, yeah, you want the MVP candidate and, you know, the guy that, you know, is about as talented as an offensive player as there is in this league. But you also be looking at that going, like, what am I getting myself into here? Like, what exactly am I getting with James Harden? I'm getting a great player, but how much baggage is he bringing with me? And if he doesn't get his way, am I going to be subject to these type of tantrums moving forward? So, look, if James Harden wants to be traded, fine. But, you know, this latest round of revelations, they're not helping his chances of getting moved anytime soon.
What's your biggest takeaway, Lakers-Clippers last night?
Not a lot. And it's mostly due to the fact that I'm not going to read anything into the Lakers till like February, because, you know, they're not even going to try, really, Doug. I mean, they're just going to mail a lot of it in the first month of the season and get guys as much rest as humanly possible. That's something even Frank Vogel kind of alluded to after the game. I mean, it's just not worth it. Like, this could be one of those years where we look at the Lakers as the best team in the Western Conference, but they finish the season as like the four seed, because they're just not going to go all out to try to win regular season games, especially not in, you know, December, January, even into February. I think they'll click it into gear sometime in March or April, and then we'll see the real Lakers. But until then, it's like, all right, Clippers look good. I mean, it's fine. They played well. But the Lakers, to me, until we get to the midpoint of the season, they're just going through the motions.
Yes, but there was a, like, again, my easy takeaways are, I don't think Marc Gasol looked particularly good, but I am willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. But, like, look, that's a major piece that they're selling people on. Like, look, now we have a legit rim protector. Now we have a stretch five center. And last night he looked, if that's what you look like at the start of the season, at the end of the season, have you played your way into shape? Or have you just been exposed as over the hill and now we can't find any minutes for you?
No, that's a good point. That's more of like I see that as a big picture potential flaw with the Lakers, not just to this, you know, to this last game. Look, the Lakers, it wasn't broke with Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee.
Right.
So if it ain't broke, you don't fix it. So, like, Dwight had found a role with that team. He was contained within that locker room, though there were some things that went on last year that certainly irritated some people within the Lakers. But he played well alongside Anthony Davis. So didn't JaVale McGee. So if you win a championship with that duo, you know, gobbling up, you know, 40 of the 48 minutes and AD playing the last eight at center, you know, why are you mixing it up? I mean, I think Gasol is one of the all-time great teammates. I think he still can be a great facilitator because his passing skills aren't going to disappear. But his three-point shooting has started to slog off in recent years, especially last year. And offensively, just not the same player. So I question that move specifically when it comes to the Lakers.
Yeah, and then for the Clippers, again, it's really early, and I know that anybody who's reasonable says, call me in the playoffs, that's when the Clippers' warts get exposed. I do think they made it clear to make Paul George more comfortable offensively. But Batum seemed like a better fit. And frankly, Serge Ibaka, they didn't have any rim protection. Like, I kind of like their additions, and I like the change of what they're doing offensively. very early, but that's reasonable to take away in such a limited sample size.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, Ibaka specifically, I thought, despite the fact that Ibaka didn't have, you know, the accomplishments that Montrezl Harrell had last season, I thought he was a much better fit. I mean, you know, Harrell is a dynamic player in the open floor, and he's an offensive rebounder, all those things that he does positively. But that's not what the Clippers need. They need shot blocking. They need a guy that can make three-point shots periodically and mid-range jumpers more regularly. That's what Ibaka does. And, you know, speaking of great teammates, another guy that's a great teammate that has a solid relationship with Kawhi Leonard. I mean, that was a big move. Now, the Clippers, I still think, might be one move away from being the type of contender that they want to, and that's at the point guard position. I think they may need to go out and try to find somebody at that slot. I've always thought Terry Rozier made some sense, you know, for the Clippers in that mix, and he could be available in the next couple of months as LaMelo Ball kind of comes around. But that to me is the one position that maybe could use an upgrade.
That's a great point. Chris Mannix joining us. I know you're going to be at the Celtics-Nets game for Christmas Day. We'll get to the Celtics, but, like, look, you and I know a lot more than we divulge, but everything we know about Kyrie Irving is he's a pain in the ass, right? He's a pain in the ass. But he can really play basketball. He is really, really, really – I would make the contention – I'm not sure he's not the most talented of all of those, you know, all of those point guards that we could kind of go list. Like, I think he has that much versatility, that much potential – and last night was a great example of that, that with all the noise and the nonsense and the media boycott, which lasted a couple of days, there's a reason that teams continue to buy in.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, if you're an Eastern Conference contender, you can't have watched that game and not been, I mean, shook might be the wrong word, but you took notice of how the Nets played. I mean, Kyrie and Kevin Durant are going to be a problem for anybody in a postseason series. These are two proven playoff performers. I know we got a long way to go before we get there, but Kevin Durant looks like the old Kevin Durant. And I've been writing this for months now because people that were watching his workouts in November that were there participated. Like, dude, he's great. Like, he's back to being the old Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant is going to be the first to kind of shrug off the Achilles injury almost as no big deal, you know, with the way he's going to play this season, I think. The chemistry issues, I think, could still linger. I mean, that was one of the bigger problems with Kyrie's Celtics, where the young players just didn't feel like they were getting enough touches or the appreciation that they needed. And that's not going to reveal itself, Doug, for another couple of months at least. You know, will Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie and Joe Harris and Jared Allen, will all these guys still be willing to buy into reduced roles as we get to the midpoint of the season? But if they do, that's the best team in the East. Yeah. I mean, unequivocally to me, that's the best team in the East because they've got two guys in the playoffs that will get you buckets.
Yeah, and they're proven that they can do it in the playoffs. It's not just they've gotten buckets in the most important of games. Okay, so then where does that leave us? What has been reaction around the league to Giannis signing the biggest contract in the history of the sport and staying in Milwaukee?
A lot of surprise. Not that Giannis signed an extension, but that he signed on for the full boat, the 5 years with the 4-year opt-out. There was, you know, a lot of people were talking about that December 21st deadline, but most of the people I talked to around the league kind of shrugged at it because they expected if Giannis was going to sign a deal that he would sign a 1+1 or a 2+1, the kind of deal that you know, gets you some financial security, but also gives you flexibility as you get into your 20s. That kind of deal could have been signed at any point. There was no deadline for that type of deal. So it wasn't a surprise that he signed an extension, that he went all in on the exact same contract he could have signed next summer. And look, we know, Doug, even if Giannis had a catastrophic injury, like say Kevin Durant did, a max contract would still be there for him with Milwaukee. Him signing this at this point was really surprising because most people expected him either to be available next summer or to be on a short-term deal.
I think the Warriors are done, and let me propose why. It's not just the result of last night. Okay, so when the Warriors, throughout their peak, right? Steph was incredible, right? He was the two-time league MVP, the first ever unanimous MVP. But the setup around him, both offensively and defensively, allowed him to be incredible. And offensively, for example, look at from Barbosa to Iguodala to Draymond, who didn't play last night but will play, to Kevin Durant. You go and look at many of his co-stars on those runs, and they had the ability to bring the ball up, to handle the basketball, and allow Steph to play without the ball. When he's probably at his most dangerous is when he doesn't have the ball, and he constantly moves, and he constantly comes off screens, and now he's a great shooter, scorer, and passer that he's behind you and you don't know where he is. This roster is so different. You know, Wiseman's not a ball handler, plus he's like 19. Andrew Wiggins is not a great passer. You know, he's like a below three assist guy for his career. I like Kelly Oubre, but again, a slasher, not a ball handler or a passer. He's gone from a point guard who can play without the ball because he has point forwards everywhere to a guy who has to really dominate the ball and create for everybody else, and that's not who he is.
Yeah, I would agree with most of that. I think obviously Draymond being in the mix makes them better. I think Wiseman's only going to get better as the season goes on. I mean, there's a reason he started that game last night. I mean, he is a physical specimen who I think instantly is going to give them credibility defensively, and he's going to get a lot of buckets in transition because he can run the floor as well as any five-man in the NBA right now. Here's where I think the Warriors' biggest issue is going to be, and this was – you could probably understand this better than I did, but I had a lot of scouts telling me in November, December, as the Clay injury revealed itself, that this Warriors offense, it's been built around two shooters. Like, Steve Kerr built this offense around having two guys that could be knockdown shooters. It just doesn't function with one guy. It just doesn't work that way. And watching that game last night, you could see it. I mean, watching Andrew Wiggins start 1-for-8 and miss every three-pointer he took, watching Kelly Oubre, you know, right around the same number, he was bricking everything. Kent Bazemore, you know, isn't making shots. Like, you know, without one of those three guys emerging as a reliable three-point shooter, I don't know how that offense operates. And I don't think they're going to be good enough defensively to not outscore you in a lot of games. So I still think they're a playoff team, but instead of being kind of a middle-of-the-pack playoff team like I had them pegged, they might be in that 6-7-8 range.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that one of the things that this is a personal belief is when you have more natural ball handlers, natural passers, guys shoot a higher percentage because you have better players creating better shots. Better passes equals better shots. And I think that you're right. It does function better when you have the space created by Clay and Steph, but you also have better shooting percentage if you have more guys that can create shots other than just Steph Curry or whatever you're doing kind of in transition. Last thing, Chris Mannix joining us in the Herd. I'm Doug Gottlieb filling in for Colin. We mentioned the Celtics. Gordon Hayward goes to Charlotte. They completely overspend, but it's not crazy. The Celtics expected that to see it coming. Kemba's had this knee thing, which he's gotten worked on. Where are the Celtics in the mix before they tip off the season?
Well, they'll miss Gordon Hayward. I mean, people talk about the contract being exorbitant. I always get a kick out of that. Like, it's not your money. What do you care? Like, they'll miss him on the floor. That's unquestioned. I mean, he wasn't the all-star. He was in Utah for many reasons in Boston, but he still was a valuable contributor in that rotation. Now, I think they can overcome a lot of that by natural development. I personally think that Jason Tatum is going to be in the MVP mix this year. I think he's going to be a guy that averages close to 30 points per game this year. I just really believe offensively this is the season, because of his own development and the opportunities that are going to present itself with this team, that he blows up. I think Jaylen Brown, as he does every year, is going to get better. Even Romeo Langford might find his way to the rotation. They're still pretty high in his ability to be kind of an eighth man with that group. The question is still Kemba. Like, Doug, that knee injury began in February, lingered after 3 months off in the bubble, yeah, and is back once again with Brad Stevens saying he's nowhere close to being able to play. We can sit here and discuss, you know, how they overcome Gordon Hayward all day long, but if Kemba's not 100%, they don't win anything. They might not get out of the first round. If they do, they're second round fodder. I mean, Kemba you know, his offense is going to be needed in the playoffs when you go up against Milwaukee, Miami, even the teams like Toronto and Philadelphia, and, of course, Brooklyn. So, to me, it's all about Kemba and what he looks like in April and May, because right now in December, it does not look good for an injury that's going on 1 year, you know, 1 year of him not being able to function properly.
Does do the Sixers make a trade for Harden?
I think it depends on the first couple of weeks of the season. I don't think that Daryl Morey lets it linger too long. If they don't, if the moves they made, and look, they're cursory moves. They do look more functional out there, at least in the preseason, than they did last year. But if Danny Green and Seth Curry and these other shooters they added, if they don't make a difference and make the Sixers look more like the team we saw 2 years ago, I think Daryl will get aggressive. And I think that's still the move I think is most likely to happen. A trade, you know, centered around Simmons and James Harden.
Chris Mannix. Mannix, have a very Merry Christmas. Can't wait to
you too, Doug.
Can't wait to read your stuff on that Celtics next game you'll see in person on Christmas Day. And we appreciate you joining us in the herd.
You got it.
Chris Mannix, follow him on social media at SI Chris Mannix, working for Sports Illustrated. Let's get you to John Goulet with the news.
No.
Turn on the news.
This is the Herd Line News.
So, Doug, on Monday night, Steelers wide receiver Juju Smith-Schuster danced on the Bengals logo during his pregame warm-up.
How'd that work out for him?
Yeah, not great. Earlier in the week, Bengals safety Von Bell had said that those dances were disrespectful, and he had to hit him to let him know where he stands. That prophecy came true when he walloped him and he caused him to fumble during the game. Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin said yesterday he is aware of the issues with the pregame dances.
I doubt any of those antics and things of that nature are legitimate motivating factors as you step into professional stadiums. But I understand it's about the quality of play inside the white lines. And so I'm not seeking comfort or looking for excuses based on our recent performances on things that occur in pregame or things of that nature.
As a former athlete, I would have to imagine that if you were a teammate of his, you might go like, dude, stop doing that, right?
I mean, the bulletin board material thing to me doesn't really, like, were they not going to hit him hard because if he didn't dance?
He would have tackled them down by the knees because of the dance. He went for you know, the body shot.
I know. What Mike Tomlin's saying, I believe, is to be accurate. It's like, none of that is really, if you need that to motivate you, like, then you probably don't love your sport all that much. I don't know. I mean, look, Jordan did create these artificial motivations during his time. So, I don't care about you dancing on, but you got to play better. You know, it's the Richard Sherman. Richard Sherman used to talk the talk, but you know what Richard Sherman would do? Walk the walk. Like, he would back it all up. Sure. And until you can do that, you shouldn't do that. And know that whether a guy's gunning for you or not, it's the perception out there. The perception is that he's not backing up. I don't care if you dance on somebody's logo or whatever. I just, you know, you got to back it up.
He did not in that game.
Did not. Has not recently. That team leads the league in drops.
And three straight losses. The dance at 11-0 is fun. Dance on a three-game losing streak doesn't fit as well.
Yep.
And finally, at 4-9-1, the Eagles had a disappointing season, to say the least. They have a quarterback controversy that's not going to go away until they possibly deal Carson Wentz. Despite all of that, their head coach Doug Peterson told the AP yesterday that he doesn't want out of Philly either by firing or being let out of his contract. I know we're going to talk about the quarterbacks a little bit later, but let me just keep this on Peterson. Just a question for you. Why does Doug Peterson seem to escape all the blame and it just all gets put on Carson Wentz's shoulders? Doug Peterson calls the plays. He runs the offense. He's a former quarterback. He can't seem to fix Carson Wentz, and yet we blame Carson Wentz for it and not Doug Peterson.
That's a very good question. I would guess the pushback would be, hey, look, they won the last two games without Carson Wentz. Carson Wentz is the problem. They won a Super Bowl without Carson Wentz. Carson Wentz is the problem. But I would agree with you. You know, he hasn't done that as an organization. They have failed. I think Carson Wentz, the biggest problem is he lost his confidence.
Yes.
You lose your confidence. But, you know, when you know you have a guy that has fragile confidence, you know what you don't do? You don't go draft a quarterback in the second round. That's like not what you do. That's mismanaging. That's not knowing your guy. Some guys perform really well. Oh, like Aaron Rodgers. Are you going to draft somebody? All right. Here's a big to you, right? But Carson Wentz ain't Aaron Rodgers. They're wired differently. You got a KYB. You got to know your boys. And I don't think his relationship is such where he clearly had any idea how Carson Wentz would perform or how to bring out the best in him.
And he also has admitted he puts so much on Wentz's plate that he can't handle it all. And then when Hurts comes in, he pares it down, and they're all of a sudden their offense runs much better.
You know, my show follows this show. It's called The Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Anyway, I had Moose Johnson on last week. And Moose got some heat because he talked about Frank Reich's relationship with Carson Wentz on how it was on a level above football. It was about their same faith, and they discussed that off the football field. And then but like Moose is right. Like, he was super tight with Frank Reich. Frank Reich leaves, and it's pretty obvious that he did not pick up the mantle and run with it and establish a really good relationship with him. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had this fissure. I really believe that. And football may be in the football business. We're all in the people business. And their relationship apparently sucks. And I do think that Doug Peterson deserves a good portion of the blame. And that's John Goulet with the news.
Well, that's the news.
And thanks for stopping by.
The Herd Line News.
Boy, the Green Bay Packers looked great when the Steelers lost the other night. Wait, what? They played the Bengals. No, I'll explain why the Packers proved themselves right watching the Steelers. I'll get to that next. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is The Herd.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific.
It's the streaming service that has everything you're into. Discovery Plus is all the shows you love from your favorite brands like HGTV, Food Network, Discovery Channel, and more. Plus, exclusive originals you can't see anywhere else. All coming soon in 2021, U.S. only. Doug Gottlieb in for Colin. This is The Herd. Look, I want to make sure that my good friend Colin Cowherd gets credit for basically telling you what was going to happen with the Steelers before it happened with the Steelers. Paper Tigers is the easy nickname to give them, right? That he did not believe they were nearly as good as their record. That adage of, you are what your record says you are. Now, I would point out that you lose Devin Bush, you lose Bud Dupree, a team that's built around their defense, specifically their linebackers, and what was the most vaunted pass rush in the NFL, you lose Dupree, that changes things, right? That allows you to slide people over to TJ Watt's side. But nonetheless, Colin was absolutely right. But you know who else was right? You know who else deserves credit? Over the last week or so, no team should be commented on about having great foresight more so than the Green Bay Packers. You're like, wait, what? And yes, I can use the downfall of the Pittsburgh Steelers as the reason why. What do the Packers get eviscerated over in the offseason? Well, you know, they didn't add a wide receiver in either of the first two rounds. It was the best wide receiver draft maybe in the history of the league. Now, it should be pointed out that I think Colin had a stat that I know has used, which is like 16 of the last 19 first round draft pick wide receivers have been busts. It's a really hard, it's a very difficult position to evaluate. But nonetheless, you look at Justin Jefferson, you look at, you know, you start to go through, you start to go, some of these wide receivers have been absolute hits. Some of them. But over the last week, three things have happened, and basically revolving around Pittsburgh, one to the Packers, and it shows that organization has incredible foresight and made the right decision twice, once in the first, once in the second round. Okay, first thing is Ben Roethlisberger. Can we all agree he looks old? Looks over the hill? Looks like his arm just doesn't have the same zip, same pop anymore. And you can sit there and go like, hey, dude, he had Tommy John surgery. What do you expect? That's fair. Okay, but he's also in his late 30s, 37, I believe. And when you look around the league, there's questions about Tom Brady's arm, about Drew Brees' arm. We all know about Philip Rivers' arm, which they're able to hide because of Frank Reich and playing indoors. But eventually, he's been the weak link at times for that team. The Green Bay Packers may have the best quarterback in the NFL, maybe ever, in Aaron Rodgers. He's unbelievable. He will be or should be the league's MVP. Somehow people are questioning an organization that won 13 games and a postseason game last year. And then their moves this year, which will likely get them home field advantage throughout the playoffs as the number one seed this year. Somewhere, and on this show, other shows, people, the Packers don't know. They don't know what they're doing. Did you see Ben Roethlisberger? Do you know what happened before he hurt his arm? He threw for 5,000 yards. It goes that quick. It just does. Do you know what happened before Philip Rivers had a disastrous season with the Chargers? They won 12 games. And then all of a sudden, you look over the hill and it's done. Tom Brady, Drew Brees, like Father Time, undefeated. And eventually, you're going to need a replacement. And drafting Jordan Love, who's 2 years away from being ready, is just about lined up with the timing of what would be reasonable to see a drop-off in Aaron Rodgers' performance, right? And if you watch the Pittsburgh Steelers, you're like, man, I wish they had the heir apparent. They don't. They tried to draft one a couple years ago, and Roethlisberger fought him on it, remember? Okay, what else do the Steelers lack? A running game. Their running game has not been the same since they lost Le'Veon Bell, since he sat out a year. I'm going to combine two things. Their lack of running game and the starting running back for the Green Bay Packers. Aaron Jones. Did you guys see who he signed with about a week ago? Drew Rosenhaus. When you sign with Drew Rosenhaus, you tell the entire league that I care about one thing in my next deal, the bottom line. Drew is a professional. He's an excellent agent. His job is to get dudes as much money as possible, regardless of who's giving him that check. So drafting A.J. Dillon protects them against that. Protects them against that. Just admit it. The Packers have great foresight, and they've built a juggernaut of a team, and Aaron Rodgers has bought into the system. They're a Super Bowl contender, if not a Super Bowl favorite, and they have prepared themselves for the eventuality that he ages and that Aaron Jones leaves. All right, coming up next, the Warriors are dead. We'll tell you why next. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is The Herd.